stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Giabili reporting. President Donald Trump fueled a growing controversy surrounding Russia's involvement in November's presidential election with attacks on NBC News and the network's political director, Chuck Todd. In two Saturday morning tweets, Trump mocked Todd's appearance, criticized the network for not providing enough coverage of unproven assertions that President Barack Obama wiretapped his campaign, and called on NBC to stop covering Russia's interference in the election. The White House, meanwhile, sent mixed messages Friday about former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's offer to cooperate with congressional investigators looking into contacts between Trump's campaign advisors and Russia if he's granted immunity from prosecution. White House spokesman Sean Spicer told reporters at his daily media briefing he was not going to give Michael Flynn or any legal advice from the podium about whether he should testify before congressional investigative committees.
But I think that the interesting thing is, if you actually stop for a second and realize what the president's doing, is that he's saying, do whatever you have to do to go up, to make it clear what happened, take whatever precaution you want or however your legal counsel advises you.
In his weekly address, U.S. President Donald Trump touts his Supreme Court pick Neil Gorsuch, saying the nomination is one of his most important actions as president. He added, the next few days, the Senate is scheduled to take a step that will protect the rule of law and democratic way of life that is absolutely a birthright of all Americans. Judge Gorsuch was confirmed unanimously to the Court of Appeals. This is VOA News. U.S. intelligence officials say terrorists are working on new ways to evade airport security. U.S. media outlets report terrorist groups have been testing explosive devices that can be hidden in a laptop and that can evade some commonly used airport security screening methods. CNN and CBS say American intelligence officials have told them militants with Al-Qaeda and Islamic State have been developing innovative ways to plant explosives in electronic devices. The news organizations say the new intelligence suggests the terror groups have obtained sophisticated airport security equipment to test how to conceal the explosives in order to board a plane. They say the intelligence played a significant role in the Trump administration's travel restriction. In Washington, the Pentagon announced Thursday that President Donald Trump has given it more authority to launch airstrikes in Somalia to attack al-Shabaab. Mohammed Yusuf has more.
The Pentagon said President Trump approved a request for additional precision airstrikes in Somalia to help African Union and Somali ground troops increase pressure on al-Shabaab and to deny the terrorists have havens from which to attack U.S. citizens or interests in the region. General Thomas Waldhauser, head of the U.S. Africa Command, had said earlier that it will be helpful for American forces to have more flexibility and timeliness when deciding whether to launch an attack. The Somali government has so far declined to comment on the U.S. announcement. Letitia Badar, a Human Rights Watch researcher for Somalia, urged caution in identifying targets for strikes in light of the ongoing drought.
This is going to be particularly key at a time where we know that there is massive displacement of civilians right now. I mean, you know, we're talking about thousands of individuals on the move trying to get access to urban areas in order to find international humanitarian assistance.
Analysts also expressed concern that local rivalries in Somalia can muddy intelligence. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Somalia's new Prime Minister Hassan Al-Khayr said he's mobilizing his government to tackle corruption and vowed to make the fight against misconduct a non-negotiable principle in its administration. Speaking at an official event Saturday, Khayr expressed his concerns about the need for Somalia to be governed on transparency principles. For nearly two decades, Somalia has been one of the world's most corrupt countries. Poland's defense minister says he expects to sign a multi-billion dollar deal with America's Raytheon to buy 8 Patriot missile defense systems by the end of the year. Poland says the $7.6 million deal is necessary in light of a growing threat from the East. I am Giabi Lee in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
The mood in the country, according to the media, does indicate that there's a lot of people saying this is a travesty.
South African President Jacob Zuma fires a popular finance minister in a cabinet reshuffle.
We are geared up for the third National Assembly election. And so far, we have registered 17-year-olds who will be 18 on the 3rd of June.
The Electoral Commission of the Kingdom of Lesotho readies to organize the upcoming June general election.
We are entitled by law to get our representatives in all of the 3,300 registration centers that the National Electoral Commission has given out.
And the Sierra Leonean ruling party deploys officials across the country to mobilize support ahead of the voter registration process. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South African Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa says President Jacob Zuma's decision to fire widely respected Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan is unacceptable. But Zuma defended his action, saying he wants people who can bring energy, experience and expertise to the job. The move, however, renewed calls from the opposition for the embattled president to resign. Shadrach Gutu, Professor Emeritus at the University of South Africa, told me President Zuma lost credibility with his cabinet reshuffle.
The mood in the country, according to the media, does indicate that there's a lot of people saying this is a travesty, in which even within the ruling political party, there's a serious division. But on the ground, people are not happy because the president has not only sacked him, but also has sacked other four ministers and two deputy ministers and replaced them. And those ministers, some of them are performing quite well. So the situation here is one where it is a question, is the president going to be recalled or not? Is there going to be a situation where he should be removed?
There were speculations that the president might have signed a deal to step down a year earlier than originally planned, and that one of the deals he signed was to fire this finance minister as part of his goodbye measure. This following Cyril Ramaphosa, his deputy president, coming out saying his decision to fire the finance minister is unacceptable.
Yeah, the Secretary General of the ruling party, the African National Congress, which is saying this is unacceptable. The president gave them a list of persons. They don't know where that list came from to approve. And most of them say, no, we are not going to approve that. So the president has a problem within the ruling party and also a problem within the country. And I think that what we are dealing with here is really a very difficult situation where there's a lot of support for the former finance minister whom he removed, because he had to bring that finance minister back after he had removed him a while ago, because ministers he had appointed were not acceptable.
Did Jacob Zuma, the president, plunge the ANC into crisis? Although I hear some people are saying that the vote of no confidence that is going to be spearheaded by Julius Malema of the EFF and possibly supported by the Democratic Alliance might not see the light of day, because the ANC, the majority in parliament, might undermine that effort to ensure that that vote of no confidence is defeated in parliament.
Yes, I think that in terms of just arithmetic, not mathematics, but arithmetic value, is that you need 201 members of parliament to vote in order to have a vote of no confidence. That means you need 89 members. And where that 89 members is going to come to join the opposition has to be within the ANC. And that's going to be difficult because within the ANC, the section in which they say a vote of no confidence, it means the president has to be removed, the ministers have to be removed, the deputy ministers have to be removed, and the minister and deputy ministers are almost 112. So they will defend their position, whether they like it or not, they want to have a job or employment. So it's going to be a very difficult thing to achieve, but the opposition is saying they only need a few members of the ruling party, and they hope that it will be one where the vote will be secret vote. And if there was a secret vote at this point, people will remove the president. But if they insist on really having public voting where you indicate who has voted for what, it will be more difficult. But as it is now, the president actually has lost a lot of confidence in the country. He is trying to misuse the country for his home or rather personal interest, patronism, and so on and so forth. So I think that that is where we are at the moment. So procedurally, it's going to be difficult, but in terms of popular view in the country, is that people are fed up with President Jacob Zuma.
Shadrach Guto is Professor Emeritus at the University of South Africa. He spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. The Independent Electoral Commission of the Kingdom of Lesotho, or IEC, is implementing measures to organize the June 3 general election. The upcoming vote will be the third since 2012 in the Southern African Kingdom. Early this month, Prime Minister Pakadita Musisidi lost a vote of no confidence in Parliament after several lawmakers from his ruling Democratic Congress Party coalition defected to join the opposition. King Letsi III dissolved Parliament following consultations with Prime Minister Musisidi and the Council of State. Tor Hansi, spokesman for the IEC, told me the electoral body will be fully prepared for the polls.
We have geared up for the 3rd June National Assembly election. And so far, we have registered 17-year-olds who will be 18 on the 3rd of June. And we have effected the transfers. And we are in a position now to print voters' roll, which is so preliminary, so that people can check their names, so that they appear, and the corrections which need to be done on the voters' roll. And apart from that, on the same note, we will be accepting or allowing the objections to the voters' roll. Not only that, but as well as maybe collecting the applications from people who would like to vote as advanced voters. So all that will be running until the 9th. And on the 9th, that will be then that the voters' roll will be distributed or be given to all political parties that which have registered in the commission.
How many people is the IEC targeting to register as you compile this voter list for the June 3rd elections?
How many is another, but then since this has been, or is for the first time this happens in the country, whereby we are heading for the elections in a situation where the Prime Minister and his government have been voted out on the motion of no confidence. So actually, we never targeted any. It was a matter of fulfilling the law and to register 17-year-olds who will be turning 18 on or before the 3rd of June. I can say to you and your listeners that we have registered 1,268,339 voters so far.
Hansi, will the IEC have the necessary funds to organize this election? Because there is debate in Parliament as to whether Pakadita Musisidi's government would have the constitutional mandate to disburse the funds that will be needed by the Independent Electoral Commission to organize this election. So would you have the funds to organize this election?
Frankly speaking, we get the funding from the government. And fortunately, we've got the funds from the government. But we didn't question, as we don't have mandate, to ask where they got and how did they source the funds to give to IEC.
Has the IEC begun educating Basotho in readiness for the election?
We started the election period on the 7th of March, and everything started on that day. So immediately when the election period started on the 13th, we engaged temporary staff, temporary vote educators, let alone that vote education is a continuous process. So in that, just to make sure that the education goes through and it gets to everyone, we have to engage civil society and non-governmental organizations to make sure that every stone is turned.
Basothos that I have spoken with are saying that they are anticipating voter apathy because this is the third time since 2012 that elections are going to be held to choose a new prime minister. They are distrusting the system because they believe their representatives are in it for themselves, not to work to improve their living conditions, among other concerns they have. How is the IEC working to resolve this particular concern?
It's true there might be that voter apathy. But what we have to do, we will put in place some strategies in which we will make sure that, in a way, we try to convince people that it's important that at the end they go and vote their government of the day. And it's so imperative that they really do, because if they don't, whoever will be doing that, the government of the day will be everyone's government. So it's really, really important that they go out, forget about the apathy, but here, to stand out in numbers and make their government of the day.
Toye Hansi is the spokesman for the Independent Electoral Commission of the Kingdom of Lesotho, IEC. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. The Sierra Leonean ruling All People's Congress Party, or APC, is deploying officials across the country as part of an effort to mobilize supporters to participate in the voter registration process. Local media reports there is an ongoing power struggle in the ruling party. This after President Ernest Bai Koroma demanded Ibrahim Bundu be replaced as the majority leader in parliament. For the latest development, I reach Usman Yansene, General Secretary of the Sierra Leonean ruling APC party.
Well, when you talk about massively deploying, in the first place, we are entitled by law to get our representatives in all of the 3,300 registration centers that the National Electoral Commission has given out. So we have to ensure that our presence is felt there by law. Our representatives, we have two in each of the centers, and that will amount to 6,600. So we are deploying 6,600 people all over the country to ensure that there is transparency, because the other political parties are also entitled to deploy representatives, so that there is going to be a transparent registration in each of the centers.
People within the party that I spoke with are saying there appear to be power struggle within the party, which they think might give the opposition an advantage during next year's election. Is there any power struggle within the APC?
Well, when you say power struggle, it depends upon the intensity of this power struggle and for what the people are struggling about. When you talk about politics, you cannot divorce it from some form of conflict. I mean, if everyone is eyeing a particular position, there is bound to be some conflict. But like the power struggle that will degenerate into internecine fighting, now it's absent from the APC.
The president has ordered the majority leader in parliament to be sacked, and some people are saying it's against the laid-down procedure of the APC. And that is why they point to the fact that the president is trying to dictate and appear to be against those who are expressing interest to lead the party in the next presidential election. What do you say to that?
In the first place, the party, it is that sent all members of parliament represent their people in the various constituencies. But then it is also the party that will decide who to become the majority leader in parliament. In the first place, let us don't forget that the first representative to be our majority leader is now the High Commissioner in London. He was removed and replaced by someone else who is now the Speaker of Parliament. Do you know what position he will be given? This is what happens in our party. The exigencies of the situation will require us to act in the best interest of our party. That is what has happened. That the party also has its own rules of engagement within parliament.
But you know, this comes a week after the president warned that there will be consequences to party officials who violated the party's rules and regulations. And Mr. Bundu, who was just removed, is one of the two presidential aspirants relieved of their positions in the party recently after declaring their interest to run for president. Why is the president doing so, they asked?
Why is the president? Why is the party? These decisions are not unilaterally done. They are done collectively by the party. You are talking about the rules. If you believe in the rules of engagement, you obey them. I mean, otherwise, you're acting against the interests of the party. Well, let me say that even Ibrahim Bundu and Almami P. Kuruma say they are part of the APC. To avoid conflict of interest, for example, Ibrahim Bundu and Almami Petutu were district chairmen. And district chairmen are charged with the responsibility of organizing the choice of delegates to the various conventions. And for the choice of members of parliament, the majority leader plays a very central role. So members of parliament want to be comfortable with people who appear to be neutral.
Mr. Dumbuya said he is acting on the instruction of the president, not necessarily the rules of engagement of the party. How do you address that?
Yeah, you are talking as if you know the rules of engagement of the party more than me. I'm the custodian of the rules. I'm the custodian of the support of the party. The speaker engages with the president, who is chairman of our party, for whatever obtains in parliament. So, in fact, Ibrahim Bundu was replaced by somebody from the eastern province, Mr. Fofana. We distribute Fofana all over the country so that every region feels part of the collective.
Osman Yansene is the General Secretary of the Sierra Leonean ruling All People's Congress Party, or APC. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. In Washington, the Pentagon announced Thursday that President Donald Trump has given it more authority to launch airstrikes in Somalia to attack al-Shabaab. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf has more on the story from the King and Capital, Nairobi.
The Pentagon said President Trump approved a request for additional precision airstrikes in Somalia to help African Union and Somali ground troops increase pressure on al-Shabaab and to deny the terrorists safe havens from which to attack U.S. citizens or interests in the region. General Thomas Waldhauser, head of the U.S. Africa Command, had said earlier that it will be helpful for American forces to have more flexibility and timeliness when deciding whether to launch an attack. The Somali government has so far declined to comment on the U.S. announcement. Letitia Badar, a Human Rights Watch researcher for Somalia, urged caution in identifying targets for strikes in light of the ongoing drought.
This is going to be particularly key at a time where we know that there is massive displacement of civilians right now. I mean, you know, we're talking about thousands of individuals on the move trying to get access to urban areas in order to find international humanitarian assistance.
Analysts also expressed concern that local rivalries in Somalia can muddy intelligence. In September of last year, officials in the Muduk region said a U.S. airstrike aimed at al-Shabaab instead targeted a militia allied to the Somali government. The local administration accused authorities in the semi-autonomous Puntland region of providing false intelligence that led to the deaths of their fighters. Al-Shabaab has kept up a steady string of suicide attacks and bombings in Somalia, despite the fact that Somali and African Union troops have recaptured much of the group's former territory. Abdullahi Halake, a Horn of Africa security analyst, said Al-Shabaab's reduced state may present a challenge for future airstrikes, in particular when it comes to preventing civilian casualties.
They are not anywhere near where they were in the middle of this decade. They have lost some of their top leadership to the American drones, AMISOM on the land and from the sea. And so they have really turned themselves into a guerrilla outfit that lives within the people.
Somalia's new president has made security a top priority, pledging to build the national army in the hope that it can take charge when the African Union mission comes to an end, possibly sometime next year. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Human Rights Watch has condemned the Rwandan government handling of land cases. The rights watchdog says military and civilian authorities in western Rwanda have arrested, beaten or threatened people who challenged recent government decisions to force residents off their land. David Himbara is an educator, political economist and author and former economic advisor to Rwandan President Paul Kagame. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him in Toronto, Canada, for his reaction to the Human Rights Watch allegations.
Well, I'm not surprised. This sort of thing goes on all the time, upheavals in different parts of the country. So, yeah, it's not new.
Now, how serious, in your view, is the issue of land disputes in Rwanda?
Well, to give you a bit of background, you know that Rwanda is about 12 million people, 70% of those in a rural area. And of course, Rwanda, the density is extremely high. There are almost 500 people per square kilometer. So really, that is a recipe for conflict, land conflict, if not well managed. Now, having said that, you have a government that is forever trying all sorts of crazy schemes. The latest is that they want to do this model village in each of the 30 districts. So that means really forced removals to create land, and very often lack or poor compensation of those who are removed. And in this case, this is happening in Rubavu district, Western province.
It seems you're saying the creation of these, what they call government-created villages, may be at issue here.
Yeah. Well, basically, quote unquote, they want to create a model village. Now, of course, there is no free land in anywhere in that country, given the high density. So that means they have to move people, and then move them to where, and what sort of compensation? Because it's always top down, the security forces can just descend on any family, roughen them up, and throw them off. So this is what this report is about.
This report also points out the Rwanda government's record on intolerance for dissent, and says that maybe these land disputes, the people have no chance against the government. Is this your view too?
Well, of course, you know that this is a country where really the freedom of expression doesn't exist. If I can refer you to the latest. The United States Department of State report on human rights in Rwanda. The population is suffocated. You can't really say anything. You can't object. Later on, express your views about your own rights.
How do you see this one's being resolved, given the high density of population in Rwanda and the government's seeming intolerance to dissent? And wanting to carry on with these so-called model villages, how does this one end up?
Well, of course, the government will eventually have its own way. The people will be thrown off. Who knows what will happen? But it's pretty well predetermined. What the government says goes. Where can you go? Where can anyone go? If the ones that are supposed to protect them are the ones that are unleashing violence on them, so there's nowhere to go.
David Himbara is an educator and former aide to President Kagame. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Toronto, Canada. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. It's now time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
You woman, you love me, you hurt me. You very special woman, you love me and trust me. Baby, see no money, get do. Oh no money, get do. Oh no money, get do. Oh no, it's about one. Other guys must sing it up. Hey, take it, baby, no. Hey, man, to my baby, no. Mama, mama, mama. No sigalala. For your inner beauty, kaku weza luti. For your inner beauty, jagari ne panga mama. Homo komu echi, koba ima suti. Because you love me and I love you. That's the way it is. You my baby, oh, oh, oh. kuchunga si tu ajali mami waseme vyaona si tunavyetu usiamini mami watachonga mambo mengi lakini mwisho watabaki na zero mimi mpenzi wako baby na kuamini nyuma hilo baby come ave don't you go ave my love it is stay you're my superstar baby come ave don't you go ave my love for you chi baby you're my superstar you my baby. Kujira wakana we were meant to be yona bebokela pana we were meant to be whatever they say nothing will stop me toba musa mbali bena musa coach bayuti muje tusige we walo kukube kuitwe mbali waya galidide shake your booty every day.
Watching over, things flowing all over, flowing all over, before the party's over, late you'll be my lover, nikubali mimi, nikupe chochote unachotaka, kwa nizi kufichi, nikifanikiwa nawe wapata, nikubali mimi, nikupe chochote unachotaka, kwa nizi kufichi, nikifanikiwa nawe wapata,
kuja tucheze, kuja, kuja tucheze,
I'm going away,
kuja tucheze,
I'm going away.
I'm going away.
Trailing and I get
I'm gonna give you what you need. Let me give you what you need. I'm in love. She makes me feel so good.
I don't see her, oh baby. What a juice on, baby.
From the continent, we hope you enjoyed it.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the law is a spider's web. Only the little insects get caught in it. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For nearly half a century, Zimbabwe has been dealing with the deadliest legacy of war, landmines. Between 1970 and 1980, during Zimbabwe's war for independence, hundreds of thousands, by some estimates even over a million of these indiscriminate killers, were sown along Zimbabwe's border with Mozambique to prevent cross-border raids into Zimbabwe by guerrilla fighters. By the time the war ended in 1980, Zimbabwe was peppered with very dense, unfenced minefields, about 240 linear kilometers of them. Even to this day, Zimbabwe is one of the most highly mine-impacted countries in the world, its danger zone booby-trapped with as many as 5,500 landmines per linear kilometer. Since 1980, more than 1,500 Zimbabwean people and 120,000 livestock have been killed in landmine accidents. Nonetheless, the need for arable land is so great in this area that farmers and pastorals have attempted to clear fields and pastures of landmines on their own. And still people die in landmine explosions, even as they go about their daily work. Over the years, the United States, along with numerous NGOs and governments, has sponsored mine clearance operations in Zimbabwe. Through the State Department's Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement, a part of the Bureau of Political Military Affairs, the United States government has provided more than $7.6 million for humanitarian demining in Zimbabwe just since 2012. One of the organizations sponsored by the United States for this work is the HALO Trust, a British-American nonprofit, non-governmental organization which removes war material in post-conflict areas. Under U.S. sponsorship, the HALO Trust is demining the minefields in northeastern Zimbabwe. Between 2013 and the end of 2015, the HALO Trust has removed over 10,000 landmines in Zimbabwe. And as the land is cleared of danger, the people move back to till and plant long-abandoned fields and to graze their cattle. They rebuild homes and cattle corrals. At last, they can collect firewood in the forest or water from a spring, take their produce to the market, and send their children to school without fear. In Zimbabwe, assistance from the United States has made a tangible difference in enabling local communities to successfully make a living on their own land.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.